You hear that? That needle scratching the vinyl. It could only mean one thing. We're talking about vinyl record demand on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Record Research, based in Menominee Falls, is an institution as a music chart reference book publisher. It's been publishing books based on Billboard charts going back to 1970. And their Vault of Music singles is a massive archive. Joel Whitburn, the world's leading authority on charted music, he died last month. Join in on Billboard charts, on data, music trivia, what you want to know about the work of Record Research, how it lives on, 800-642-1234. Paul Haney is head researcher at Record Research. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Good morning. I just want to say that I'm sorry for your loss. What did Joel Whitburn mean to Billboard chart music? What was his impact?
Well, Joel Whitburn started the company Record Research back in 1970. And not coincidentally, that's the same year that Casey Kasem started his radio show, American Top 40. So between the two of them, they really made chart watching into something more than just the industry professionals. Actually, I count myself among the chart fans who got started when I was 8 years old back in 1974. Me and my older brother would listen to American Top 40 every week. And it wasn't too much longer after that that I discovered the work of Joel Whitburn and his reference books, which actually told you how high a song got on the Billboard charts.
I'm like you. I didn't miss. I just didn't miss an episode of Casey Kasem. I was glued in as a kid. What did Joel teach you about this work?
Yeah, like I said, I was a customer for many years before I actually started working here, and I actually was in radio for a little while after college, and our station got sold in the fall of 91. So I thought to myself, what would I like to do other than radio? Well, my number one dream job would be to work for Joel Whitburn in Record Research. So I came over here in 1992, and I've been here ever since. And yeah, Joel not only was my boss, he was also my professional mentor and just a dear friend. And yeah, it's been quite a shock that we lost him a little over a month ago. But yeah, Joel taught me, first and foremost, he taught me that accuracy is the most important thing in this line of work. Printing reference books, you want to be accurate. And Record Research was known for that accuracy over the years. So Joel really instilled that in me.
Why keep chart books of popular music?
Well, it really tells the whole history. I know Joel often told me several times that he actually started the company because he found that in the music business, there was a lot of hype. And he would see artists on talk shows saying how many number one singles they had. And Joel would say, well, that person never had a number one single. So there was actually no place to look that stuff up back in the 50s and 60s until Joel came along. So Joel actually invented the concept of chart research, and it really does give an insight into popular culture.
We're talking about music, hit songs, the research behind it. Paul Haney from the Menominee Falls publisher of music chart reference books. You can join in, 800-642-1234. I want to get to some music here. Kate Bush's 1985 pop single, Running Up That Hill. It's back on the Billboard Hot 100 charts after, you know, playing this prominent role in Stranger Things season 4, currently ranking 4th on the list and number 1 on the Global 200 list for 2 weeks straight. Let's listen to a bit.
Tell me we both met it, don't we? You. It's you and me. It's you and me.
How often And do you see songs previously in the charts returning to the top of the lists?
Well, that's an interesting point because the way the charts are constructed nowadays, if a song, no matter what the age, if it gets into the top 50 on Billboard's Hot 100 chart, in other words, if it has enough points from streaming or downloads or radio airplay, then it can come back on the chart. And any song can do that. I know a few years ago we had Fleetwood Mac's Dreams.
Dreams, yes.
that one came back on, right?
That was the viral TikTok of a man skateboarding while drinking, you know, cranberry juice. You know, would that be like a happy accident?
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, television is a big driver in this stuff. And I was so happy. I was tickled when the Kate Bush song came back on because that's one of my favorite songs from 1985. I remember playing that one on my college radio station. And isn't it amazing? Here we are 40 years later. The number one movie is Top Gun and the number one single is Running Up That Hill.
I guess what comes around goes around, maybe.
Yeah, as a child of the 80s, it does my heart good.
So, you know, as head researcher, what is your method for going about researching a new chart book? Can you take us into this work?
We have done several editions of our flagship book, which is called Top Pop Singles. That's the first one that Joel published back in 1970. And I think we're on about our 15th edition now. And the last book that we put into one edition went from 1955 through 2018. And the book got so big. In fact, it was like 1,400 pages, so we actually had to split it into two volumes, and we printed the 1955 to 89 book last fall, and that one sold really well, and we are doing the 1990 through 2022 volume two, and actually Joel was able to finish the work on it before he passed. Yeah, he was at his desk the day before he died, so he was putting the finishing touches on that book.
Why would the book be a book? I mean, have you thought about putting this information just online as a digital tool?
Yeah, we actually have ebooks available on our website, which is recordresearch.com. And we have found that because we do reference books, we find that most of our customers actually still like to have the printed book in their hands. That way, you know, there's no clicking around. You can actually, you know, get that book in your hands and you have the whole history there and you can just start flipping around. And like I call it going down the rabbit hole, you know, you start thinking of an artist and then it makes you think of another song, another artist. And again, it does my heart good that our customers still want the actual printed books.
Well, another song, another artist. Let's hear another one. Billboard Hot 100 lists As It Was by Harry Styles in the number one slot this week. Let's listen.
When everything gets in the way.
Oh my gosh, Paul, Harry Styles has become a force to be reckoned with. He's everywhere.
Yeah, it's amazing how those guys from One Direction have really got their own solo careers going now. But you know what? That's nothing new, right? I mean, look at the Beatles. You know, they all had the solo career and even some of the new kids and some of the other groups over the years. Like I said, what I love about our company, Record Research, is we delve into the whole history, you know. We keep up on it. Joel was 82 when he passed away, but you know what? He still kept up every week on the charts, and he would come to me and he'd say, "Paul, I heard this great new song by Ed Sheeran," and he would get so excited about it. I don't know too many 82-year-olds that are into Ed Sheeran.
I love that. Paul Haney, head researcher at Record Research in Menominee Falls, for decades filling this niche as a music chart reference book publisher, kindled by a half century of passion by the late Joel Whitburn, whose company published nearly 300 books. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about record research. The founder, Joel Whitburn, who died last month, built a record collection that includes every charted Hot 100 and pop single going back to 1936, every charted pop album back to 1945, not to mention nearly complete collections of country, R&B, adult contemporary. Join in on these reference books, 800-642-1234. Paul Haney, head researcher at Record Research, with us for about nine more minutes. Paul, give us a sense of, you know, I just, you know, clicked off some of the massiveness of this record collection. Where do you keep it all? What is the vault like?
Well, yeah, that's very interesting. Joel, back in, I think it was around 1986, 87, he got the idea to actually build an underground vault off his basement in his Menominee Falls home. And it's actually got fire doors. And I often joke that it would survive a nuclear blast. And I often would go in there, and I still go in there from time to time because, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I was into the vinyl. And like Joel always said, it was like visiting all his old friends down there because he knew all the album covers and all the 45 picture sleeves. And, of course, you're probably too young to remember all this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's take a call here. Richard now in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi. I collect a lot of vinyls. I probably got 5,000 of them. But my question is, okay, like, you know, I've been looking for a long time for It's a Beautiful Day album, and I finally found one. And my question is, what are some of the rarest and more sought after albums, if I ever come across, that I should snatch on to?
Richard, thank you. Paul, what would you suggest?
Wow, that's a great question. I think the most expensive one in Joel's collection is, and Beatles fans will know this, it's called the Butcher cover. It was kind of a controversial cover at the time. And that album alone can be worth up to like $10,000 just for that one album. And Joel, not only does Joel have all of the charted albums, but he also has a pretty big collection of non-charted things that he's picked up over the years. Because Joel, in order to grow this collection, he actually used to go and buy out large record store collections and also collections from jukebox dealers. And I used to go on some of those record hunts with him, and those were a lot of fun. One of the great perks of my job, we actually traveled all over the country looking for records. So, and of course, with the Elvis movie out now, there's been a resurgence in the interest of those Elvis albums. And some of those albums from the 50s are worth a lot of money these days. So you can never go wrong with Elvis and the Beatles.
Where would you go for your scavenger hunts, if you will, to buy out record collections?
Well, one of the funnest ones I remember, I think, was back around 95, 96. My coworker Brent and I actually flew out to Pittsburgh, and there was a shop out there called the Attic Records. And we came back with over 1,000 R&B 45s. And we got quite a few stares going through the airport that day. We actually were able to bring it on as carry-on. So that was, of course, before 9/11 and all that, so you could do that back then. But, yeah, that was probably my favorite one. And then there's a record store called Toad Hall in Rockford, Illinois, which is about 90 minutes from Menominee Falls. And we went there several times looking for old 78s and you'd have to be really old to remember what a 78 was. That was even pre-45, so you might want to ask your grandparents about that one.
Let's bring on another call now. Dale is with us from Oshkosh. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Good. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I'm a long-term, I used to work at record stores all across. I worked at the Exclusive Company in West Bend and then Oshkosh, and then even out east, and I love the thrill of the hunt. I love, like, it's so funny because I used to work in those record stores in, like, the, you know, early 2000s, late 90s, and vinyl was just kind of a joke, and now it's just made a huge resurgence, and I think it's because of that, like, the big format art, you know, and a lot of them comes with, like, download codes. Like, with Spotify, that's kind of going away, but, like, it's always nice to have that digital format forever, but, you know, having that big art and the presentation of putting on that vinyl record just, oh, it feels so good. And I wanted to give a quick shout-out. There's a record store up here that he got us started at the Exclusive Company back in the day, but it's called Eroding Winds. And he just opened up a new location in Appleton, and it all specializes in vinyl, and it's just crazy to think that, like, a dead format is now making such a resurgence that he just opened up another store. Like, I love seeing it. I'm a huge music and vinyl file, so it's a great conversation. Thanks for having it.
Dale, thank you so much for that. Paul, what do you make of the vinyl resurgence?
Well, to tell you the truth, it really flabbergasted me, because I remember when CDs came along in the late 80s, and the record companies couldn't get rid of the vinyl fast enough. I mean, they literally just stopped making vinyl records and forced everyone to replace their collections with CDs. Now, in my case, I didn't mind that, because I'm more about the music, and I wanted to hear the music, you know, without all the pops and clicks and crackles. And what's interesting about this vinyl resurgence is, I think I read this in a story online somewhere recently, that up to half of the people who are actually purchasing don't even own a turntable. They're just getting it for the art, the artwork. So, yeah. So now, granted, some of those people do end up buying turntables, you know, and
they'll come around eventually.
yeah, I would think so. But but you'd be surprised how many people, you know, just want to put it on their walls for artwork.
We're talking about record collections. Hit Music with Paul Haney from a Menominee Falls publisher of music chart reference books, 800-642-1234 to join in. Paul, is it easier now to find vinyl and not even set foot in a record store? What is the impact of online sales?
Yeah, online sales have really, really eaten into the brick and mortar stores. But again, you'd be surprised how many of those stores are still available. In fact, I went into the local Borders store in Milwaukee, and I was actually shocked to see that their vinyl section was about five times the size of their CD section. So, yeah, it's I think, you know, the vinyl is, I guess, it's really here to stay.
Let's go to Chris now in Shorewood. Chris, hi.
Hello. I have an old-fashioned Victrola that I wind up and I play the 78s on, and I have volumes and marvelous classical and modern, and many from my friend in Norway of the old-fashioned 78s. And I'm 92, so I'm trying to think what I can do with this. I was going to give the Victrola to Shorewood's drama department, but I never heard back from them, so it is sitting in my living room.
Oh, Chris, thank you. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, you know what, Chris? You may want to take that to maybe one of the local record shop, independent shop owners, and just see if there's any interest there. I know some of those guys actually do collect the actual, you know, the hand crank turntables. And a lot of them, I don't know, depending on what the artists are for the 78s, whether there's a lot of interest in those. But again, you'd be surprised what some of those 78s can be worth.
Chris, thank you. Paul, what is next for record research?
Well, before Joel passed away, I had several discussions with him because he had been in some ill health. And Joel did say that he wanted the company to continue after he was gone. We'd hoped to have him around a little bit longer than we did. But like I said, I've been here for a little over 30 years, and my coworker's been here for over 40 years. And Joel's daughter is actually the new president of the company. And she's been, of course, with Joel her whole life. So the company's in good hands, and we plan on publishing the books. I alluded to volume 2 of our top pop singles that Joel was working on. That will probably be coming out later this year.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate. It's been fun.
Paul Haney is head researcher at Record Research in Menominee Falls. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the history, the politics, the culture of air conditioning here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. An analyst from J.P. Morgan said this week that air conditioning makers are in a golden era. Demand for new and replacement AC units has been strong since the financial crisis a decade ago. And there are other reasons to be bullish for those analysts as many developing countries start plugging into AC. Do you live without air conditioning either at home or at work? How do you manage? What strategies do you take to stay cool on weeks like this? Do you think the air is too cool at your work or public places? And have you heard or been part of the office temperature debate? We're at 800-642-1234. Penelope Green is a feature writer in the style department of the New York Times. Her recent piece is called "Do Americans Need Air Conditioning?" Penelope, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you looked over 100 years ago to the beginning of this technology. Why do we have air conditioning?
Well, we have air conditioning because a junior engineer at a printing plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, figured out a way to blow air over water and reduce the humidity in this printing plant that was gumming up the pages of a humor magazine that was being printed. For millennia, there have been some sort of cooling, mechanical or otherwise, and this really revolutionized it and made it possible to do it more efficiently and put it out there.
And when did we see air conditioning take off? How did it rise in popularity?
Well, they refined the systems and refined the systems. And by the 30s in the White House, there was central air conditioning. And by mid-century in this country, at least, electricity was cheap enough and the technology was good enough that it was in most homes. And, you know, we know it changed manufacturing and it allowed huge areas of the country to be developed. Florida, Houston, the Sun Belt, Singapore, globally, it's called the air conditioned nation. I can give you some fun facts about air conditioning in the White House if you're interested.
Yeah, something about President Nixon.
Well, it was President Nixon loved the air conditioning to be turned down so low that he could turn on the fire, have a fire in the summer. And Lyndon Johnson similarly liked it so low he wanted to sleep with an electric blanket over him in the summer.
You also write that without air conditioning, we'd have no internet because server farms get really hot and they depend on air.
Yes, absolutely. There would be many, many, many industries that would not exist or be possible without air conditioning.
And almost 90% of American homes have air conditioning. Is there any evidence that all this temperature regulation is altering our behaviors or our lifestyles?
Well, I mean, there have been surveys, global surveys done that have shown that those who are in sort of less developed countries have a greater comfort with temperature variability. But I think that, you know, on balance, it's altered our lifestyle for the good. I don't think anybody suggests that we should do away with air conditioning.
Help us understand building efficiency standards. Why do we have them, and how is air conditioning involved?
Well, many states, including New York, have put laws into place that require that will reduce the carbon emissions of the buildings, which are big, big producers, polluters. And in New York State, the benchmark is to reduce carbon emissions by 85% by the year 2050. And air conditioning is a factor. It uses a lot of energy. Interestingly enough, it does not use as much energy across the country as heating does. We use four times more energy to heat our homes and our workplaces than we do to cool them. But the way air conditioning fits into this, again, it's a big energy load, and buildings will be built to these standards that just make them more efficient with better insulation, green roofs, delivering the energy to cool and to heat the spaces with renewables like solar.
When I think of air conditioning, in my youth, I think of the window unit that was hauled down from the attic, put into the window, and then turned on. How have window units impacted efficiency?
Well, not being an HVAC engineer, any engineer of any kind at all, I can tell you that window units get better, but just on balance, they're less efficient from an energy standpoint than central air.
Penelope Green is a feature writer in the style department of the New York Times, and her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? It's a question that might get a resounding yes, given this week's temperatures. Are you curious about the invention and expansion of air conditioning? Are you concerned we've become too dependent on AC? Do you try to cut back on using it in your own life? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can also email your thoughts on AC to ideas@wpr.org. Penelope, in what ways do we overconsume air conditioning? Where do we go overboard?
Well, I think that, again, not being an energy expert, I think that in terms of the experience of people in offices, office workers, many of whom are women, will complain that the AC is just too darn high, and they're freezing in their offices. So I think that that's where the debate comes in, at least in New York City. There's lots of back and forth about the space being engineered or cooled to the thermal comfort of men in suits, and there can be charges every summer that, you know, it's a sexist gendered temperature, and there's lots of debate on Twitter about that.
Is there merit to that claim that temperatures are adjusted for male employees?
There really isn't. I mean, not in my, you know, very cursory reporting. Our building on 41st Street is cool to what are known as just an industry standard of 76 degrees. And the building is built with the AC in its floors, and we have ductwork or fans rather at every single desk, and employees are able to sort of open that vent or close that vent in an effort to kind of customize their space. And again, in a sort of anecdotal survey of buildings around the city, most buildings are set to that temperature. The standard by an organization called ASHRAE really asks that building facilities directors alter the temperature of the building or make the temperature of the building something that's comfortable for 80% of the occupants. And that means that 20% of staffers are going to be uncomfortable or miserable.
Yeah.
Too cold or too hot.
And your piece kind of reignited this debate about air conditioning, especially on social media. What was the internet response to your article? What did people say?
Well, my Twitter feed lit up with a lot of women tweeting that they were freezing in their offices, and it lit up with a lot of men being enraged that anybody suggests that office temperatures were too high or too low. Mm-hmm. It was quite funny.
Let's go to Owen now in Weawega. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hello. I had to shut off the radio there, and I think AC makes us lazy. I'm on the farm, and I actually wear long sleeve shirts all summer long. Not so much for UV protection, but just because I actually find that kind of air conditions me, because I get covered in perspiration, and the cotton shirts kind of keep the moisture around your body so it doesn't evaporate so quickly, and that actually keeps me cooler. But my wife, Lisa, sleeps in the room with the AC and the window unit, and I sleep in the living room because I find if I sleep in the AC, when I wake up, we get up at 3, we're outside by a little after 3, I even find it's 10 times hotter if I spend the night in that AC room.
Oh, because your body temperature is adjusted to the room that is air-conditioned.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, even when I'm in my truck, I do the same thing. I'll turn the AC on sometimes just so I can see out the windshield, because it has an air dryer. You know, your AC actually dries the air and takes some of the moisture out of the air, which helps when you need to see, but I always roll the windows down at the same time because I don't want to become spoiled and feeling like I'm not climatized to the outside temperature. I grew up with no AC. My father and mother, I'm 40, my father and mother always said that we didn't need AC in Vermont because we only had 3 months out of the year when it wasn't, you know, below 65 degrees anyway. And in the wintertime, we tried so hard to keep it at 62 degrees or you know, in that range. So why would we fight to keep it at a different temperature and spend more money on energy during the summer?
Owen, thank you so much for describing your story. Penelope, you know, Owen's saying, look, air conditioning makes people kind of lazy.
Well, I think that, you know, many would agree with him, and there are studies that have been done, again, that show we, you know, we're so adaptable as humans, and we get used to certain things. That said, I think that nobody would want a manufacturing plant or an assembly line to not be air-conditioned, but certainly in one's home, you can, you know, you can make yourself. You know, I'm a Northeasterner, and you know, we do try and keep our thermostats low in the winter for energy reasons, and you can get used to temperature swings if you really work on it.
Penelope Green is with us. She is a feature writer at the New York Times, and she's been writing about air conditioning. Are you concerned we've become too dependent on it? Are you concerned about the energy use and the climate change impact of all this air conditioning? Do you try to minimize your AC for that reason? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. When the summer heat wave arrives, so does this long-standing debate over the thermostat. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Should the air be cranked up? Should there be throw blankets around the office? The U.S. and China account for over half of the world's air conditioners. According to the International Energy Agency, the number of AC units installed globally is set to jump from about 1.6 billion today to 5.6 billion in about 3 decades from now. Do you live without air conditioning, either at home or work? How do you manage? What strategies do you take to stay cool on weeks like this? Are you concerned our world is becoming too dependent on AC? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. And Penelope Green stays with us. She is a feature writer at the New York Times. Penelope, through your reporting, you interviewed an architecture firm that in 2015 designed its workspace without the convenience of air conditioning. What did you find there?
Oh, this was a wonderful, wonderful experiment. The company is called Kieran Timberlake, and they have 100 employees, and they are, a design-forward company trying to sort of figure out how to minimize their impact and the impact of their work from an energy standpoint. And they renovated a former bottling plant, which was made of concrete and steel.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, and it was built at mid-century, and they decided to do this renovation with, the lowest sort of energy impact possible, and they designed the place with passive house technologies, and those are sort of principles. It's a German standard. The idea is to maintain a steady interior climate by making the building envelope pre-airtight and install a system, mostly fans and things like that, to exchange the indoor and the outdoor air. And passive house principles usually mean that you could reduce your energy impact by about 60% to 80%. So they put in mechanical ventilation, that means fans, natural ventilation, that means windows that open, automatic shades to shade the building during the, from the hot sun, it was very, very well insulated, thick concrete slab floor and dehumidifiers. And the idea is to basically regulate the temperature the way buildings have regulated temperature for thousands of years, like a Roman villa, shading the place against the hot summer sun during the day and then opening up at night to flush out the hot air. And it was complicated. The first summer they opened, the staffers were miserable, and they were surveyed sort of at all points during the day, and basically, and they tried all sorts of things. They tried, working early in the morning when the heat wasn't that great, changing the dress code. People could come to work in shorts.
The employees said they were melting.
They were melting. They really were. And they brought in, fans for the desks and more floor fans. And finally, they just realized that, too many of their staffers were miserable. So they switched to what's known as a mixed mode operation. They brought in conventional air conditioning, but used it sparingly, and that's how the place runs now. And it's a good model for other buildings.
What should we take away from this experience? What did work?
Well, there are two things to take away. One is just the climate in Philadelphia, and maybe that building in particular. Passive house technology without conventional cooling, I mean, most passive house building has some kind of cooling in it, but passive house, it works best in places with big diurnal temperature swings like the desert. You could probably do it in the desert where it gets quite cold at night without any conventional cooling at all. But in most places, you do need some air conditioning system. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is they developed a survey technique, a cloud-based app called Roast, and they just, they surveyed their employees constantly, and it helped them refine.
I'm sorry, I'm just laughing at the name of that app. I mean,
I know it's great.
Oh, dear. So they really had to keep an eye on their employees because they don't want their employees to leave them over the temperature. I mean, for goodness sake.
Exactly. And here's another really important thing about that experiment. 41% of Kieran Timberlake's employees at the time were female. And so one wondered and one asked, were the respondents who were most miserable men? And in fact, it was not the case that there was a gendered response to the heat. Everybody was pretty miserable. They did learn, however, that more women responded to the survey questions than men.
Let's take another call now. Larry is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. First of all, I was raised on a farm in central Wisconsin, no air conditioning. You'd work out in the field all day, and you'd sleep at night and sweating. But anyway, every factory that I worked in except for one didn't have air conditioning in it. I don't know where she's getting this that factories have air conditioning in it. I worked in a tractor manufacturer. I worked in an outboard manufacturer in different various job shops, and only one of those had air conditioning in it. So I don't know where you're getting this that most factories have air conditioning in them nowadays.
What does the factories you've been in and worked in, Larry, what did they feel like in the summer?
Well, they're hot, but I mean, it's the same thing as in a few degrees warmer than what it is outside, but you struggle through the day. I mean, it's, I guess it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You either want the job or you don't. And, you know, that's just my thought. I mean, it, like I said, on the farm, now in the days, yes, the tractors have air conditioning, but back in the old days, you wanted to stay cool, you put a fan, umbrella over the seat, and you at least got shaded. I mean, it is what it is. I think, like the other farmer said, we've gotten soft.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Penelope, I mean, if you want the work in the factory, you go to the work, regardless of the temperature.
It is the case that fans are, which were, you know, which electric fans came into play in a widespread way at the same time that our friend in Williamsburg invented the what would become the conventional air conditioner. You know, fans have altered manufacturing as well, and it also may be the case that there are regional differences that companies and industries further south may have to deploy air conditioning, and in places like yours, where the temperatures aren't quite so brutal, it might be possible to live without it.
Well, let's fit in one more call here. Justin in Madison. Hi, Justin. Nope, Justin is not there. You know, Penelope, climate change is only going to make our world warmer. What can we expect for the future of air conditioning?
I just think that it will get more efficient and buildings will get more efficient. Certainly in this country, many, many states have enacted similar laws to the ones that we have here in New York City and in New York State to curtail the carbon emissions of new buildings and retrofit older ones, commercial spaces, that is. So I think there's a lot of hope in ingenuity.
Although at the same time, around the world, countries are, basically plugging into air conditioning, China being the other biggest user of air conditioners. How do we see other places around the world changing their perspective on air conditioning?
Well, I think that as countries grow richer and they can afford it, they're going to clamor for it. And the you noted some statistics about that. We can only hope that climate change agreements like the Paris Accord will be taken up by developing nations, and they'll do the right thing.
Penelope, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Penelope Green is a feature writer in the Style Department of the New York Times. Her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? And we have a link to it on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.